Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Princeton University Press Ideas Podcast, a joint production of Princeton University Press and the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Jorel Melendez-Badillo, author of the book Puerto Rico, A National History. Jorel, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mark. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, we're really glad to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Great. So I am from Puerto Rico originally. I was actually born in the United States in a military base in Fort Benning, Georgia, because my parents were both in the military, but I was brought to Puerto Rico 2 weeks after, and I was raised in Aguadilla, which is on the western coast of the archipelago. And I like to say that Aguadilla is the capital of the Caribbean, just because some sense of pride. I did my BA and MA in Puerto Rico. I studied history, went to the United States about 10, 11 years ago to do my PhD in Latin American and Caribbean history, thinking that I was going to come back to the archipelago. And I'm currently physically here in Puerto Rico. But then life took me to other routes. I taught history at Dartmouth College. And as of 2 years, I am teaching Latin American and Caribbean history in the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
That's a very prestigious posting. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So what led you to undertake a history of Puerto Rico, especially, you know, sometimes that's the sort of book a historian writes, you know, near the end of your of their careers. You're still very much, you know, you're at the, you know, at a very early stage. You're and it's a very fascinating book. I mean, I'm looking forward to getting into it. But what led you to decide that now is a good time to write a history of the island, you know, from beginning to the present?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I was thinking about when I started writing this project is this mandate, basically, the way I see it, from a late historian of Puerto Rican history, Fernando Picó, who used to say that every generation needed to rewrite and rethink the history of Puerto Rico because there were no absolute histories. And it's from there that I wanted to depart with the book. Also, the epigraph that opens the book is by another writer, Jose Luis Gonzalez, who argues that historians cannot simply yield light on the messiness of Puerto Rican history, but need to seek to sort of untangle it and understand it. But in reality, beyond those sort of intellectual mandates, you know, there was an opportunity. I was in dialogue with Priya Nelson, my editor at Princeton, and I was trying to pitch another book. And so she was the one that actually brought up the idea of writing a history of Puerto Rico, a longue durée history of Puerto Rico. And I thought to myself that in life, there's certain opportunities that you have in front of you, and you either take them or you end up thinking about them for the rest of your life. And I thought that this was the type of book that I was going to write later in my career, as you rightly mentioned. But I decided to take a stab at it. And I had, before talking to Priya Nelson at Princeton, I had delivered a lecture at Springfield College, where I was given the task of summarizing 500 years of history, of Puerto Rican history, in 50 minutes in this sort of keynote lecture. And so that was the first stab that I had at sort of this project of trying to think this sort of broad history and try to condense it. And so the way that I see it, the book is actually a sweeping history of a Caribbean country that has been colonized for more than 500 years, first by the Spanish and then by the United States. But it's written with, although it is written with academic and scholarly rigor, it has sort of like an intimate sensibility. And so I begin the book with my own family's history, with my abuelos and my abuela, my grandparents, sort of to highlight the intimate dimensions of this sort of story that I'm trying to tell, which is a history of Puerto Ricans' agency throughout those five centuries. And so I like to mention that because, you know, oftentimes I thought to myself when I was writing it that this was a daunting endeavor, writing a national history, more so in 200 pages or less. But for me, it was a narrative exercise on trying to untangle this question, which is the question that animates the book, of how although Puerto Ricans lack a sovereign nation state, for centuries, Puerto Ricans have crafted a complex idea of the nation, an idea of a nation that is fluid, that is legally ambiguous, and that it's also diasporic, which is another dimension that I wanted to bring into the conversation, because I am deeply inspired by the work of historians that came before me. And in fact, I dedicate the book to my mentor, Blanca Silvestrini, who wrote herself a national history of Puerto Rico almost 3 decades ago. But I wanted to also incorporate the diaspora because I am part of that diasporic community in the United States. And so the book ended up being a history of Puerto Rico from pre-Columbian societies to the present day. And I like to joke with my students that it's a history of Puerto Rico from pre-Columbian societies to Bad Bunny, because the book actually ends with Bad Bunny and one of his songs in one of his last records, El Apagón. And so that's what I was trying to do with the book. Also, the last thing that I wanted to mention to answer your question is that I also wrote it thinking that I wanted non-academics and non-specialists to be able to grasp the history of Puerto Rico. And so that did not mean that it was less academically rigorous, but it posed a challenge to me in terms of the ways that I crafted the narrative, that I was really intentional in trying to write for other audiences beyond the classroom, beyond my scholarly communities.
And I think that stands out in terms of your approach, because one of the things I was struck by as I was reading it was how it's a history, and it's all those things you described, but there was a tone very much of the present, that it was very much speaking to the here and now. There was an immediacy to what you were writing about that I thought was really interesting, especially for a book that covers such a wide span of time in its various chapters.
Thank you. I appreciate that you say that, because it was definitely written with a sense of urgency, a sense of I call it a future-oriented history. And in our field, you know, in the past couple of years, there's been a huge debate, particularly in the United States, about the role of the present in the production of history. And so for me, I wrote this history because I'm interested in the future of Puerto Rico, right? And so that meant that the book was, although it was thinking about pre-Columbian societies, it was thinking about the Spanish colonial period, about the first 100 years of the U.S. occupation and the U.S. government and colonialism in Puerto Rico, it was still trying to figure all of this in the hopes of creating new avenues for other futures in Puerto Rico. So absolutely, I am glad that you picked that up, because it was certainly written with a sense of urgency, particularly because we are sort of like in a turning point in Puerto Rican history and Puerto Rican politics. And so my book sought to sort of invite people to look at our past, our multiple past, in order to sort of draft that path forward. So it was definitely there's certainly a project there of trying to think carefully, critically, and also alongside Puerto Ricans about our future.
I was wondering if you could take us back to that pre-Columbian past where you start your narrative in the book. How long have people been in Puerto Rico? What were those communities like? What was their initial encounter with Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. So there have been people in Puerto Rico for thousands of years. The first migrations, there's certainly scholarly debates around when actually the first pre-Columbian societies arrived in the Puerto Rican archipelago that they called the Boriqueng. But there's some consensus around 5,000 to 6,000 years ago. And so they had to create, one of the things that I wanted to do in those first chapters was to highlight the ways that pre-Columbian societies had vastly complex societies. They had a political structure, they had systems of religious beliefs, they had social codes. And so we know very little of these communities because, as I mentioned in the book, to understand the pre-Columbian past means that there needs to be a careful dance between anthropology, archaeology, and history. And so most of the things that we have from pre-Columbian societies is from the records that were produced by the Spanish conquistadores during the first stages of the conquest from 1493 onwards. Although the Puerto Rico was officially, quote unquote, discovered by the Spanish, as they used to call it, in 1493. And one of the things that I say in the book, or I tell my students in the classroom, is that I like to think about it the other way around. There were some Spanish people that were lost at sea, and they were found by the indigenous communities of the Caribbean. But they landed in the archipelago in 1493, and it's not until 1508 that the official conquest of Boriquén began. And by then, the indigenous communities that lived in the archipelago had vastly complex systems, as I had mentioned. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight in the book was not only the agency of indigenous communities, but it was also the ways that they were connected to one another. So back then, rivers and waterways were not borders, but avenues for communication and interaction and networking. And so when the Spanish arrived in Puerto Rico or in Boriquén in 1493, they found empty huts. The indigenous people had run away. And so it was not because they did not know what they were seeing, but it was because, I argue, perhaps it was because they had already heard of what they had done in the neighboring island of La Española. And so in those first chapters, I tried to highlight the complexities of their societies. And I also argue that perhaps not knowing a lot about what they believed, what they understood, their social imaginaries, might have been because, you know, their knowledges were passed down through oral traditions that eluded the historical record, the written record that we're so used to in our Eurocentric ways of understanding history. And so in the book, I also highlight their agency through a major insurrection that took place in Puerto Rico in 1511, led by a cacique or a chief called the Guaybana II. And so this was the first of many wars between indigenous communities and the Spanish. And so I wanted to highlight this because when I was growing up in school, I was taught about the docility of indigenous communities in Puerto Rico. But what we find when we look at the historical record is that they were resisting the conquest from day one, not only through insurrections, but through multiple ways that were not often open and violent, right? They used different means. And so those first chapters try to highlight the social worlds that indigenous peoples created, their agency, and then the book moves to the arrival, the forced arrival of another group, which is enslaved African and African descent peoples in Puerto Rico, which created this sort of mixture and connection, particularly from runaway indigenous peoples and runaway enslaved peoples that met outside of the limits of the Spanish crown and forge communities and forge connections. And so I tried to yield light on the complexities of that first initial stage of the conquest from the pre-Columbian societies that arrived 5 to 6,000 years ago to the communities that they build in the margins of the Spanish colonial project. And then the book deals with the consolidation of that colonial project in Puerto Rico, which lasted almost 400 years.
It's interesting to read about how the Spanish, you know, tried to govern the island, because there's definitely themes that you identify there that end up emerging again when we talk about the American occupation in 1898. About how you have Spain valuing Puerto Rico for reasons that have, you know, nothing to do with the inhabitants themselves or their interests, but with Spain's larger interests, and also how oftentimes they were governing it with greater regard to issues that mattered more to Spain than to the Puerto Ricans themselves. So there's a sense that Puerto Ricans have you know, their struggle for agency long predates the United States. It's been a thing that dates back to the 16th century.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. So one of the things that I, as I mentioned, I wanted to highlight was the agency of Puerto Ricans in the context of a constant colonial process from the Spanish to the United States. But Puerto Rico for the Spanish imperial government was important just because of its geopolitical position in the Caribbean at a moment when they found other sources of income, of gold, of guano, of metals, of silver in the Americas. There was a phrase in Puerto Rico in the Spanish colonial period, particularly in the 1500s and early 1600s, that people used to say, Dios me lleve al Perú, may God take me to Perú, because people wanted to escape the harsh realities that they were living in Puerto Rico. And so in the first sort of 3 to 4 chapters of the book, I try to highlight the complex realities of Puerto Ricans in the archipelagos. And then there's also a question of when can we call these people Puerto Ricans? When did they start imagining themselves as something other than Spaniards, as something other than indigenous, something other than African? And so that for me is a very important question that I sought to address in the book without providing an answer, because I wanted to leave it for the reader to decide for themselves. But the first time that the term Puerto Rican was used by official documents, in official documents, was in 1704, 1705, and it was synonymous to bastard. So it was Spanish officials complaining about the large amount of Puerto Ricans, meaning bastards, that were born out of the relationship between Spanish military men and women of the archipelago. And so for me, it was very telling that the first time that the word Puerto Rican was used by the state was in that sort of form. And so by the 19th century, that term has been resignified by the people of Puerto Rico. And we have in 1868, and I dedicate a chapter to it, an insurrection, which I call the revolution, the Lares insurrection, that takes place at a moment when there's a revolution happening in Spain, known as the Glorious Revolution, which was a liberal revolution. You have a revolution in Puerto Rico on September 23rd, 1868. And then you have another revolution in Cuba that led to 3 decades of war that eventually led to its independence. But in Puerto Rico, in that revolution of 1868, what interested me for the book particularly was this idea that a medical doctor who is very prominent in the book, Ramón Emeterio Betances, who spent most of his life in exile, he was one of the organizers. He argued that they were doing this revolution because they already had created the Puerto Rican nation. They just needed to create the nation state. They needed to create the political apparatus. And so we see how in the 18th and 19th century, there are conversations in Puerto Rico about the meanings of being Puerto Rican. And so in the late 19th century, there's a host of a young intellectual generation that is thinking about very carefully about the meanings of being Puerto Rican. And it's a very problematic notion as well. I criticize it in the book because it also, they created this racial democracy myth of the mixture of the African, Black, the indigenous person, and the Spanish white person. And from this mixture, they say that they argued that they created the great Puerto Rican family, which in reality also silence any conversations around anti-Blackness. It was also very patriarchal. But in the book, I try to problematize all of that while also showcasing how there were people in Puerto Rico and abroad, some of them were studying in Europe or in Michigan, that were thinking about this question of when did we become Puerto Ricans? What does it mean to be Puerto Rican? And so all of that to say that throughout all these centuries, the people that have inhabited the archipelago ever since they started calling themselves Puerto Ricans, and even before that, as we see with the indigenous communities that revolted against the Spanish, there has always been this desire to resist the identity imposed by the imperial metropolis.
And that's something that becomes even more complicated after 1898. It's one of the things I thought was really I hadn't really considered before when I was reading your book, but there that Puerto Rico seemed to be on a particular trajectory that then gets completely disrupted with the American occupation. And then you have these complicating factors. You have, on the one hand, the occupation by a very different group of people with different attitudes, especially racial attitudes, from the Spanish. Not necessarily, you know, totally different, but distinctively different. And at the same time, you also have this, the beginnings of the establishment of a diaspora, which really does, you know, introduce new elements that simply have been missing for hundreds of years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting because in 1897, the Spanish government granted Puerto Rico autonomy. And so they created what they called the Autonomic Charter. It was granted to Puerto Rico and to Cuba. In Cuba, Cubans didn't accept it. They were fighting for their independence. So they did not accept the autonomy that was granted by Spain. But in Puerto Rico, they created an autonomic government. And this happened months before the U.S. occupation. In fact, the autonomic government that was created was to meet shortly after the U.S. occupation. So they never actually got to meet formally because the occupation happened on July 25th, 1898. But as you were mentioning, yes, there was a path towards autonomy and who knows, maybe independence. But what really what we do know as historians is that Puerto Ricans were on the path to having autonomy. And in the book, I explain the process of how this came to be. Is a really complicated yet very interesting case of an anarchist, an Italian anarchist, assassinating the Spanish prime minister, which eventually leads to the autonomy of Puerto Rico. And so it's a fascinating story. But shortly after the United States invades, as part of what was called the Spanish-American War, which I like to call the War of 1898, because the Spanish-American War erases the participation of Cubans, of Filipinos, of people from Puerto Rico in the war. But this was a turning point in Puerto Rican history, as you mentioned. Puerto Rico had been a colony of Spain since 1493 or 1508, when the conquest officially started, until 1898. Spain, at one point in history, was the biggest empire in the world. They used to say it was the empire where the sun never sets because they had colonial possessions all around the globe. However, by 1868, when that insurrection that I mentioned happened, they only had Cuba and Puerto Rico as their last two possessions in the Americas. And so in 1898, it was a major blow to the Spanish empire. But for Puerto Ricans, it was a turning point. It went from being a Spanish colonial possession to a possession of the United States. And it's a very complicated process. Puerto Rico was under a military rule, a military government from 1898 until May 1st, 1900, when the United States passed the Foraker Act, which created a somewhat democratic government. And I say somewhat democratic because it was not perfect, as I explain in the book. And from 1900 to 1917, Puerto Ricans became Puerto Rican citizens, which in the international arena meant nothing. So they were sort of in a legal, international legal limbo from 1900 to 1917. However, in 1917, Puerto Ricans are granted U.S. citizenship through the Jones Law. And so oftentimes in the past, historians would argue, you know, they were granted U.S. citizenship as the United States was entering World War I. They needed soldiers for the battlefield. But in reality, not a lot of soldiers, if any, made it to the theater of war in Europe. And I mean Puerto Rican soldiers. It was a vastly more complicated affair. There were sectors in Puerto Rico that wanted U.S. citizenship. But it's a very complicated world. That law that granted Puerto Rico or Puerto Ricans U.S. citizenship was amended in 1920 with the Merchant Marine Act, which was this protectionist law that sought to protect U.S. corporations. And it basically argued or mandated that anything that gets exported or imported in Puerto Rico needs to be imported through the U.S. Merchant Marine on a U.S. vessel flying a U.S. flag with an all U.S. crew. Now, the U.S. Merchant Marine is one of the most extensive marines in the world. And that means that still today, that Merchant Marine Act is in operation. We pay high tariffs for all of the things that we consume in Puerto Rico or that we import. And we need to keep in mind that Puerto Rico imports more than 85% of the things we eat. So all of those things are taxed. And so it's a vastly complicated moment at the turn of the 20th century where there's a new polity that emerges in Puerto Rico. All of these things that happened, the Foraker Act, the Jones Law, the Merchant Marine Act, did not happen in a vacuum. There were people in Puerto Rico actively discussing them, as I show in the book. Not only the elites, but non-elite actors like the working classes begin organizing unions. Women begin organizing around the vote. And so there's a lot of political mobilization in the early 20th century. And lastly, as you mentioned, there's also this racial regime that gets implemented in Puerto Rico, not so different from the Spanish racial codes, but it was the U.S. racial codes. And so there's a series of Supreme Court cases that dictated the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States. And they're still the law of the land today. And they're known as the insular cases. And so from 1901 to 1921, they were decided by the Supreme Court in a series of cases. And just to summarize it for time's sake, they argued in those cases that Puerto Rico belonged to, but was not part of the United States, and that the United States flag did not follow the United States Constitution did not follow the Puerto Rican flag, the U.S. flag, meaning that right now I am physically in Puerto Rico. I am not fully protected by the Bill of Rights. As soon as I get on a plane and I land in Madison, Wisconsin, I am fully protected by the U.S. Constitution and its Bill of Rights. And so all of that created this sort of sense of a second-class citizenship for Puerto Ricans that still is part of our realities and everyday lives in the diaspora and in the archipelago. And the last thing I'll say about these insular cases, I have a friend, Monica Jimenez, who's about to publish a wonderful book on race and law in the creation of modern Puerto Rico. And she shows, and I mentioned in the book and I cite her, how some of the justices that decided the first insular cases that dictated the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States were the same justices that ruled in Plessy v. Ferguson that segregated the U.S. South. And so all of this laws and opinions and all of this legal infrastructure that was created immediately after 1898 was racially coded and understood Puerto Ricans as too savage, too rowdy, not fit for self-governance. And those laws are still, and those legal structures are still in place today in 2024.
And they have a very important effect for what you are describing in your book during this period, which is the sense of nationalism that is perfectly understandable considering that Puerto Ricans, as you describe, are finding themselves unreconciled to a country that claims sovereignty, yet does not offer equality it's like even when you're seeing reforms and changes, it's they always seem to be qualified in such ways as to cheapen them and make them seem not really to address the true concerns that Puerto Ricans have.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that I do in the book and in my previous work is I highlight the ways that after the U.S. occupation, a lot of people thought that Puerto Rico was going to be better than the times that they that than the Spanish times. In fact, the working classes, it's really interesting. You find books written by socialists and anarchists that cited Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, because the United States was understood as the pinnacle of democracy, of labor rights. And it was not only in the working classes, which is the people that I've studied in my previous work, but different sectors of society really understood this moment as a moment of change, as a moment of potential progress. And so there's this sort of disillusionment that happens 2-3 decades after the U.S. occupation, where the elites, for example, find themselves outside of not reaping the benefits of the U.S. occupation, as I demonstrated in the book and a host of historians have demonstrated in Puerto Rican history. Puerto Rico became, in the words of Fernando Picó, a vast sugar plantation. There were absentee sugar corporations that were reaping the benefits of all of this production that happened post-1898, but the elites, the working classes, everyday Puerto Ricans were not reaping the benefits. And in fact, when the Great Depression happened in the United States, its ripple effects were disastrous for Puerto Rico and for Puerto Ricans. And we also need to take into consideration the geographical position of Puerto Rico in the Caribbean. The first challenge that the United States faced in Puerto Rico in 1899 was not revolt or revolution against them. It was a massive hurricane that destroyed the archipelago. And the same happened in the 20s and in the 30s. And so you had that violent mixture of elements that created the ripe conditions for the nationalist movement to emerge in the 1930s. Independence had been advocated in Puerto Rico for centuries. The 1868 insurrection was a pro-independence insurrection. I document in the book an independent sentiment since the early 1800s. So it's been there. But in the 1930s, the situation that had been created, the material situation that had been created, pushed the Nationalist Party to become an armed party. They did not see themselves as succeeding or getting any form of progress or independence through the ballot box. And so it created a very complex situation in Puerto Rico that I document in the book, where there was a lot of violence on behalf of the nationalists, but also from the state that targeted any sort of nationalist or pro-independence sentiment. The first challenge that the United States faced in Puerto Rico was not an insurrection or a revolution against the occupation, but it was the wrath of a hurricane in 1899. And the same happened in the 1920s and the 1930s. And so what you have after 1898 is a series of policies that were enacted by the United States that created what historian Fernando Picó called a vast sugar plantation. So it was a vast sugar plantation composed of mostly absentee corporations that were reaping the benefits of the land in Puerto Rico and taking that money away. And so very quickly, all of those social sectors that had been in favor of the United States because they understood it as a pinnacle of liberty and freedom, like, for example, the working classes, where you find socialist and anarchist books that cite George Washington or have epigraphs with Abraham Lincoln, they quickly became discontent with their new reality. And particularly the elites were also discontent by the late 1920s, like 1930s. The situation pushed them to create a discourse of anti-Americanism, anti-U.S. sentiment that also fed the nationalist movement that had been organizing in Puerto Rico since the 1920s. And pro-independence sentiment can be traced, as I trace in the book, throughout Puerto Rico's history. But in the 1930s, it created this sort of boiling point where the nationalist movement abandoned the electoral route and they became an armed group, resistance group against U.S. colonialism in Puerto Rico, which created a dire situation, a violent situation, not only on behalf of the nationalists, but also on behalf of the state that sought to squash the Nationalist Party without paying attention to the conditions that created this movement in the first place.
And that seems to be a recurring theme that you see over the course of the 20th century and really down to the present day, which is this idea that that nationalism and the national movement is something that can be addressed through surveillance, through monitoring, through oppression when necessary, and the underlying issues that are oftentimes fueling the demand for independence just simply go ignored or sort of papered over.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that I wanted to do in the book was also highlight how, although this is a national history, it's not an insular history. I tried to, from my analysis of pre-Columbian societies to the present, I try to locate the people that have inhabited the archipelago in connection and in conversation with people from abroad. And I say that because after 1959, in the height of the Cold War, and I mentioned 1959 because of the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban Revolution created a ripple effect in Puerto Rico. And so those sort of sentiments that we had seen in the 1930s that also led to revolutions in 1950, led to the attack on Congress in 1954, they became even more intense. And so there was this, Puerto Rico became this sort of Cold War battlefield for pro-independence groups that became part of the armed guerrilla movements. There were a lot of urban guerrillas, but also there was a very active repression of any pro-independence sentiment in the archipelago. When I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, my grandfather would tell me not to use the Puerto Rican flag because he remembered the repression of the pro-independence movement. And I talk at length in the book about this moment, which I call the new push for independence, in which you had these armed guerrilla groups, Marxist organizations, trying to advocate for revolution. And then you had this brutal, brutal repression, not only from the state, but from right-wing conservative groups that were putting bombs, kidnapping individuals. So it was a very and very messy, complicated history that, as you mentioned, oftentimes ignores the conditions that create this sort of complex history. And so that's one thing that I also wanted to highlight, because oftentimes when we read the history of Puerto Rico in the 20th century, the history of modern Puerto Rico, it often goes something along the lines of 1898, the U.S. occupation, 1917, the Jones Law that granted citizenship, 1952, the creation of the Puerto Rican Commonwealth, and then the 1980s, 1990s, and that's it. But I wanted to add a more porous analysis by highlighting the ways that different sectors of Puerto Rican society, not everyone was an armed guerrilla member. There were also intellectuals in the university thinking about the university, about the role of the university in creating the nation. There were people that were advocating new political projects from the ground up. And then you have the Puerto Rican diaspora, which also comes into play in this very important moment in the second half of the 20th century.
Now, we could talk about this, you know, in terms of what's been happening over the past 100 years. But as you describe in the final parts of your book, I mean, this is something that is, you know, ongoing. And this is something that many listeners may recall or be familiar with in terms of what happened just a few years ago with the twin blows that Puerto Rico suffered from Hurricanes Irma and Maria, which not only, as you describe, really devastated so much of Puerto Rico, but also for which the population received such an inadequate response from the United States, and how this seems to underscore how, you know, the past isn't past. It's very much present in terms of what Puerto Rico is dealing with today.
Absolutely. Hurricane Maria became, and Hurricane Irma, but particularly Hurricane Maria became a turning point in recent Puerto Rican history. And so I say that because we need to think about the recent moment. I like to begin with, usually when I talk about this with students, with colleagues, I'd like to go back to 2006 because that's when the Puerto Rican debt crisis began. In 2006, and on May 1st of that year, the Puerto Rican government shut down for the first time. And it basically was the alert that the crisis that we had been talking about for decades had finally arrived in Puerto Rico. And ever since then, it's been an ongoing cycle of fiscal, social, and political crises. And so Hurricane Maria arrived at a moment that the Puerto Rican government had recently said that it could not pay its debt to the world. It had finally admitted what everyone knew. The Puerto Rican debt was unpayable. It was a moment in which the Obama administration had passed the PROMESA law that created the fiscal oversight board known in Puerto Rico as La Junta, of unelected members that came to, quote unquote, fix the economic woes of Puerto Rico. And then in this very intense political and economic moment, you have Hurricane Maria that barreled through the Caribbean. And so it became a turning point in the ways that everyday Puerto Ricans conceptualize themselves in relation to the United States. And so in the book, that was the hardest chapter for me to write. It was a chapter that entailed a lot of emotional energy. It was a chapter that made me cry more than once. It's a chapter that I sometimes cry when I had to revise it multiple times in the copy editing and in the editorial process, because it's so ripe and it's still, for, so I'll sum it up this way. For a lot of people, Maria never left. And Maria basically it's still here, and it highlighted the ways that second-class citizenship that scholars had theorized was lived in the everyday realities of Puerto Ricans. And then you had the federal government saying, particularly the then president of the United States, Donald Trump, saying that Puerto Ricans want everything done for themselves, when in reality, as I document in the book, through scholarly sources, through my own lived experiences, it was actually community efforts that saved Puerto Ricans. So it was not that Puerto Ricans wanted everything done for themselves. It's that if Puerto Ricans had not come through for themselves, the reality would have been far worse than what we had, which was pretty terrible in itself, with a study led by the Universidad Carlos Arvizo and Harvard University estimating around 4,645 people that died as a consequence of Hurricane Maria. And not about the, it's not the consequence of the storm, but its aftermath and the failing infrastructure and the colonial neglect of both local and federal officials. Because one thing that I also highlight in the book is that this is not simply a history of empire colony. It's also a history, it's a complicated history, because you have an administrative class that is reaping the benefits of this arrangement between Puerto Rico and the United States.
Well, we appreciate the time you've taken with us to speak about your book. But before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. So right now, I'm currently co-editing a volume with Professor Aurora Santiago Ortiz from UW-Madison as well, titled Interrogating the Future of Puerto Rican Studies, where we have about 21 scholars thinking about Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricanness, and Puerto Rican studies writ large. And that's coming out with Duke University Press next year. I'm also working on a monograph on about anarchism in the Americas and the broader Atlantic world, called The Counter Republic of Letters, Radical Networks in the Atlantic World. And I'm starting to dip my toes in a new project called Educating for Empire, U.S. Higher Education and the 1898 War in Cuba and Puerto Rico.
It sounds like quite a few projects you have going. You sound very busy.
and I need to sleep somewhere in between and get some rest.
Well, I look forward to reading these books, these projects when they're published.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Jarella, thank you very much for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You as well. Thank you very much, Mark.